We'll call to order the House Interim Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. And I'd like to introduce to the committee the staff people. We have Patricia Nielsen and Janet Atkins, our right-hand person, in the real chair. Let's see, when I start down there with Representative Grun, and have each of us introduce ourselves and tell a little bit about our district.
Sure. Good morning. I'm Representative Bruin. I represent House District 37, which is all of Tualatin and all of Westland, Stafford, a little bit of Lake Oswego. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome.
Mike Schoffler, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland.
And I'm Representative Alan Brown from House District 10 over on the Central Oregon coast.
Representative Kevin Cameron from here, District 19, South Salem, Almsville, Turner area.
Peter Buckley from Jackson County. I represent Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, Jacksonville, and a small portion of West Medford.
And I'm Representative Paul Holby from represent South Eugene, South Lane County, and home of the Ducks.
My name's Chip Shields. I represent District 43, North Northeast Portland.
And everyone else on this committee got assigned here, whether they wanted to be or not, and Representative Shields volunteered.
Very interested in making sure that we have a lot of living wage jobs in this state.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, see, we need to start by the adoption of the committee rules, as I don't know whether everyone's had the opportunity to look at them. I assume that they're pretty well the standard committee rules that's put out by the clerk's office. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the rules? Seeing none, committee rules are adopted. Okay, Janet, let's see, where are we going to start here this morning? Yeah, we're going to have Corey Steisinger here this morning to tell us a little bit about her department.
And Mr. Chair, you already have packets from DCBS, so you look forward to it.
Good morning, Corey.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here this morning. And for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as Ms. Adkins said, we have provided you with some materials that are mostly in a folder looking like this. I don't have prepared testimony, but I am going to be referring to some of those materials. And in particular, probably mostly the one that looks like this, which is our accomplishments during a brief summary of our accomplishments of our during the last biennium, and also what we are focusing on and working on during this biennium. And what I would like to do is just briefly review the subject matter areas that we cover and some of the issues that we see as current, as some of what our plans are, and then, of course, it's our expectation that you may very well be interested in some of those and want to hear more from us as we move through the interim. The department, our mission is to protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state of Oregon, and all of our programs are really aimed at that. We are the largest business regulatory agency in the state, and we have a fairly broad focus. We cover five major regulatory areas, but a number of different programs within those. And I would like to start with workers' compensation. And the workers' compensation, our workers' compensation division, as you probably know, is in charge of making sure that workers get have workers' compensation coverage, that is, that employers provide the coverage which is required, and that injured workers get timely and appropriate benefits. And we also facilitate injured workers returning to work. That's one thing that Oregon's program really stands out in the our ability to, when a worker is injured, help them return to the workforce, which benefits the worker and the business. And that could include vocational services, incentive programs for employers, and so on. I think that most of you are probably familiar with Oregon's workers' compensation story. We're pretty proud of it. We have just announced for 2006 that once again Oregon's workers' compensation premium rates will stay flat. That is a record, national record, of 12 years of decreases followed by 4 years of flat rates. We also reduced the assessments that we charge for administration of the system, returning $33 million this coming year to employers and workers. We're proud of that statistic, but we also get a little nervous about that statistic because we want to make sure that we can keep up the record for the future. And I will say, while we have done that, keeping the rates down and then flat, we have also increased benefits to workers. Oregon is roughly in the median, but we have, in the recent couple of bienniums, improved benefits for workers with permanent partial disability and permanent total disability. And this last interim, you passed a bill to solve some problems in the permanent total disability area. Permanent partial disability was a major piece of legislation in 2003, and I want to let you know that it is scheduled to sunset after the next legislative session. So one of the things that we're doing this interim in conjunction with the Management Labor Advisory Committee is taking a look at that, because we assume you are going to want recommendations about continuation of that permanent partial disability benefit structure. We are also busy implementing the legislation you passed last session to improve the system of providing independent medical examiners for injured workers. You may recall that there was quite a bit of concern expressed that that process of having those exams done was not fair, and this new system puts our department in more of an oversight role of that process. So we're working now on implementing that. But there are some longer-term areas that we work in here as well, because Our declining rates have they're subject to a number of pressures. The biggest single reason that we've been successful in keeping rates down is we've been successful in having workplaces get safer, and that's of course our goal. And we have had declining injury and illness rates. We also, of course, are successful in getting workers back to work. But medical inflation costs hit the workers' compensation system just like they hit other parts of the healthcare system. And so that pressure, upward pressure, continues. So we are, first of all, we want to continue to keep those accident and injury rates going down. And that brings us to Oregon OSHA, which I'll get to in a minute, also part of our department. But in workers' compensation, we're looking at a couple of other things that I just wanted to give you a heads up on. One of them is what we call a medical quality initiative. And that is how to look at how medical care is delivered in the workers' compensation system and whether we can ensure that that care continues to be high quality but also the most cost effective. And I think if you talk to healthcare experts, they will tell you that cost and quality don't have a linear relationship. Sometimes the most costly care doesn't produce the best outcomes. Bad outcomes produce more costs. So we are looking, and we're doing a sort of open discussion with stakeholders in workers' compensation about how can we get to that sort of sweet spot of cost and quality care. And that's a long-term project, but when we look at the workers' compensation system, I think if 10 years from now you look back, hopefully you'll say, yeah, that was the right discussion to be having then. So that's another major project that we have underway. One more that I should touch on in the workers' compensation area is we are taking a look at the assigned risk pool. The assigned risk pool, we have a voluntary three-way market for workers' compensation in Oregon. An employer can choose whether to purchase workers' compensation insurance from Safe Corporation, whether to purchase from a private insurance carrier, or whether to self-insure if they meet financial criteria. But if they get turned down, because the voluntary market, both safe and the private sector, can turn you down, and if you get turned down, you still are required to have workers' compensation insurance. So you go into a pool, which we administer, the assigned risk pool. It's very similar to, for example, auto insurance. If you've had a lot of accidents, you're not going to be able to get auto insurance on a voluntary basis, but there is a pool through which you will be able to get it. Same with homeowners. We have a fire insurance program, which is sort of the last resort. Same with health insurance. So there has been a lot of concern expressed about, is the assigned risk pool working the way that it should? A lot of small employers end up in the assigned risk pool. that may be a good thing because there are some discounts available to them. They may be there because it's cheaper. But we don't know. So we are actually, and this was a subject of quite a bit of discussion at some of your committees last session, although no bill ultimately was passed, we're taking a look at that whole structure. Who's in the pool? Why are they in the pool? How does that affect their costs? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Are there recommendations that we should make? I want to, at this point, introduce a couple of people who are key to the functioning of the workers' compensation system and who you and your constituents may have the opportunity to call upon, and those are the two ombudsmen that we have in workers' compensation. We have a small business ombudsman for workers' compensation. His name is David Walkie. David, you want to stand up? And we have an ombudsman for injured workers, who's Jennifer Flood. Jennifer? And you will see contact information for both of them in your packet. They are in this booklet that I referred to, but we have also provided you with a general contact sheet that looks like this and a brief description of what they do. And for constituent issues that you may have, if you have a small business that may have trouble getting insurance or a question about premiums or how they are classified, David is here to help you and your constituent with those issues. If you have a constituent who is an injured worker and is having trouble getting through the system, needs information, wants maybe some guidance, Jennifer and her staff are here to help you. You're welcome to contact them directly or have your constituents contact them directly. You'll see in your package we also have a brochure that each of their offices puts out. They look like this. We have more of those if you'd like. And we are happy to work with you however's most convenient. We can provide information to you to help your constituent, or we can just work with the constituent directly. So I wanted to make you aware of both of those and make sure you knew who these people were. They're very valuable to us in running these programs. I wanted to switch then to Oregon OSHA, which I mentioned briefly, because the safety components of what Oregon OSHA does, of course, are critical to the success of the workers' compensation system, but even more critical to sending people home safe and healthy at the end of the day, which is really our goal. And Oregon OSHA, of course, inspects work sites and enforces the workers' work safety laws. We also provide extensive consultation and training, because really workplace safety works well when employers and workers are all bought into the concept of safety. Safety doesn't happen because we're out there doing inspections and hammering, although that's a necessary part of the system. Safety works well when everybody understands the importance and the value of it. And you will see some of the materials we have included in here about OSHA that include information about the consultation services. So again, if an employer is having problems with their workers' comp rate or with claims, one of the things we always ask them is, do they know about OSHA's consultation services? We are looking at some specific areas. You know, I assume you saw the unemployment reports, and those are great. That's great news for Oregon that we are seeing an increase in job growth, and in some areas, including construction, which is, I think, at record rates right now. But that carries a risk with it, because one of the things that we have learned, actually, is that injuries tend to happen when employees are new on the job, really to an amazing rate. About one-third of serious disabling injuries happen during a worker's first year on the job, 10% during the first month. So those are avoidable injuries, but they also, when we're in a time of economic expansion, present some real risks to us. So that's an area that we're focusing on. We always focus on construction. We are starting to look around the corner and focus on the healthcare industry and injury prevention in healthcare. And I want to introduce someone else at this point who is our new head of Oregon OSHA, Michael Wood. Michael's sitting right here. And I would encourage all of you to get to know Michael. He joined us in September. He has a lengthy experience with the equivalent agency in the state of Washington, very deeply knowledgeable about industrial health and safety and what a program like this requires. And we're really looking forward to him working with you over the next few years. So, and Michael's also available to answer any questions if you'd like. Either his contact information, you will see we've got all of our administrators' contact information on this sheet and also in the back of this book. So moving on from this area, I'm going to briefly talk about building codes, but only very briefly, because Mark Long, who's the administrator for our building codes division, is here, and you're going to be hearing from him later in the agenda, and he's going to talk about some of the key areas that he's working on. I think you probably know that in building codes, we set the statewide codes, and we have responsibility for some of the statewide programs, which are boilers, elevators, manufactured housing. But most code work and enforcement in Oregon is handled at a local jurisdictional level. Most local jurisdictions do plumbing and electrical and structural permits and inspections and plan reviews themselves. There are some areas in the states where we do it, but most of Oregon, it's done at a local level. So it's a collaborative relationship. We have been making very good use of technology recently. Mark's going to talk about some of that. We've been, along with other areas of the department, really focusing on regulatory streamlining, which you're going to hear about further as well. But again, I won't spend a great deal of time on those issues because you're going to hear from Mark. I did want to mention one issue, though, which has received a fair amount of press attention recently. Those of you who read the Oregonian, I'm sure, have seen the articles on construction issues. We, as a department, are providing a great deal of the staffing for the construction claims task force, which you set up during the last legislative session to look at a number of these issues. It is being staffed not only by the Construction Contractors Board, but also by Mark and his staff in the Building Codes Division, and also our Insurance Division staff, because one of the, for the construction industry, one of the reasons to be so interested in this is not only the prevention of defects, but also the impact of defects on insurance rates. Not at all dissimilar to the relationship between OSHA and workers' compensation that we just talked about. The most effective way to reduce insurance rates is to reduce claims. So that task force, which again I think Mark's going to talk about in a little more detail, is up and running. We are very actively involved in looking for solutions to those problems. I do want to talk briefly about the insurance division, which is next. There are a lot of issues that we're working on in insurance focused on health care. I think your constituent, you probably hear from your constituents like we do from ours about being concerned about affordability and availability of health care. Those are always concerns of ours. One of the areas that we're working on most seriously at the moment is transparency, to make sure that information is available to allow consumers to make wise decisions about buying health insurance and then about choosing health care options if they do have insurance. We're also working on some of the larger policy discussions that the legislature and the governor's office are involved in. We will be working this interim to implement Senate Bill 1 on mental health parity that you passed last session. That's a major project that's already underway. Some of the other areas that are just on our screen that I'll mention briefly, long-term care insurance. We put new rules in place to make long-term care insurance more portable as people move from state to state and also more reflective of the types of long-term care options that are available for elderly people today. We're continuing to work with the Department of Human Services on those issues because as we have an aging population, long-term care insurance is one of the pieces of the package that we want to make sure people have the ability to consider. Another issue that that probably produces as many consumer calls as any is the issue of total loss auto insurance. So that's something we're taking a brief look at. As I mentioned, the insurance division is also helping staff the construction claims task force. One other item I wanted to mention, because it's certainly been a hot topic in the past, and that's medical malpractice insurance. And we have all been, I think, in the past concerned about rates and the effect on health care access. You probably recall that in the 2003 session, we did put in place a program to provide some rate relief for doctors in rural parts of the state. That will be sunsetting this coming session, so we'll be looking again at what the next steps are. But we are starting to see some softening in the market. We just took a regulatory action, which you may have seen. Northwest Physicians Mutual, which is a local mutually owned one of the two major medical malpractice carriers in the state, is being bought out, and it's being bought out by a national company called the Doctors Company. We have just approved that purchase. We think it is going to bring greater financial strength, and one of the immediate impacts is going to be the lifting of a moratorium on coverage for new doctors in some of those high-risk specialties, including obstetrics, which is obviously an area of great concern. We are also seeing that Northwest Physicians' rate filing for next year has an average decrease of 8.3%. It's the first decrease we've seen in quite some time. We're very happy to see that. And we are seeing a reduced frequency and a softening of severity trends. So I'm not here to give you a market report, but that one indicator is a good indicator, and we're certainly continuing to keep a close eye on that market. I wanted to spend just a couple minutes on our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. That's a lot of programs in this area, some of which I know this committee is interested in. This area, we include the regulation of state chartered banks and credit unions, and also consumer finance companies, payday lenders, title lenders, pawn brokers, money transmitters, debt counseling agencies, quite a few entities that that get a lot of attention from time to time, and that pose that both provide services to consumers in need, but sometimes provide financial challenges as well. I know, of course, that you've got a subcommittee looking at payday and title lending issues specifically. We have met with the chair of that subcommittee and intend to be providing information and help as that process goes forward. We have some new tools that the legislature was kind enough to give us last session that will give us better ability to issue cease and desist orders and take enforcement action against unlicensed entities that the law requires to be licensed. That can come into play with respect to secondhand shops, which have been another source of interest recently, particularly in the Portland area. And if any of them are actually engaging in pawnbroking activity without a license, and there's some indication that may be the case, we now have some better tools after the first of the year to try to ensure that they stay within the bounds of the law. We are also looking at ID theft issues, which are of concern to the financial community as well as, I know, a number of your constituents. And one final area that I should mention that we are looking at is mortgage lending. Of course, with the housing boom continuing, we are seeing a proliferation of mortgage, both refinances and initial mortgages in the state. We want to make sure that that system stays consistent with the regulatory framework that the legislature has directed. We do see some issues in areas where the individuals actually originating the loans are not closely supervised by the licensees, and so that is an area we're continuing to look at. One final program, and I know I'm covering a lot of material here, but as I said, we can always come back on anything that interests you specifically. You may have been seeing a fair amount in the papers or from your friends and neighbors about the new Medicare Part D prescription drug program for elderly. And it creates a lot of questions. It creates a lot of issues. I want to put in a plug for one of our small but important programs. It's called SHEBA. It's the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program. We gave you one of our SHEBA brochures. SHEBA is the volunteer network that provides counseling for people who need help figuring this process out. And if I think the media does a good job of giving the toll-free number out, and if you do have constituents who need help, we would encourage you to call SHEBA, and we will do our best to provide your constituents with the information that they may need, or your parents or family members, for that matter. I always like to talk about regulatory streamlining. Office of Regulatory Streamlining is located in our department. There's a lot going on, but Pat Allen, who is the head of that office, is here, and I don't want to steal his thunder. I will tell you that we have there was a sizable legislative package that you folks passed last year in the regulatory streamlining area. A lot of those bills are being implemented. Within our department, we have a lot going on. We are using some online licensing tools, for example. We have been piloting use of what's called My License and License 2000 We have a series of licenses in building codes and our finance area, which now people can apply for online from their desktop, pay for with a credit card. That system's just been implemented within the last year. We are, I think, at upwards of 30 licenses that we now issue that way. We're looking at 90. We have a lot of licenses. Initial reaction's very good. I think we have over 35% of people who are renewing licenses are doing it online, so we're expecting to see that more. We are leading a statewide user group with a number of the other agencies that are looking at these products as well. We're continually looking for ways to make our forms shorter, our paperwork burdens less, and ourselves more efficient. I'm happy to answer questions on any of this. I feel like I've been sort of going at lightning speed here, covering a lot of material, and I apologize for that, but I think at this point I will stop and see if there are other things you would like to hear about.
Thank you, Corey. There's a new director of the finance section, is that right?
The finance and corporate security section, a position we have an acting administrator at the moment. His name is David Tatman, and he's been the deputy, and we're in the process of a recruitment to fill that position on a permanent basis. We will actually be opening the position up in January, and if any of you have stakeholder groups that you would like to see on the list for the materials for that announcement, we'd certainly be happy to do that.
You mentioned the mortgage activity that's going on. I think that when I go through my emails each day, that the only thing that exceeds the Viagra advertising on there is the people offering me opportunities to get a new mortgage. Is all that activity?
Some do both too.
These mortgage companies, are they all licensed entities, or who are they?
Well, that's a good question. We license mortgage lenders and mortgage brokers. There is some out-of-state activity, and we would like to hope that's not a response to me, that all of those entities are properly licensed. If you're getting solicitations from either out-of-state companies or companies who you have questions about, we would be delighted to check whether they are properly licensed, and we do have some tools if they are not. We do not separately license loan originators, who are the individuals who do the loan processing. They are registered with us, and they need to be working under the direct supervision and control of one of our licensees. That is the area that we're spending some time looking at. We want to make sure that if we hold a licensee accountable, that they are appropriately holding accountable the folks who are working under their name. And at the moment, sometimes those relationships can be a little attenuated.
And also, the telephone calls. When I check my phone messages, so about 50% of them at least is probably from a mortgage company wanting to give me the opportunity to get a new one. Lower interest rate.
Well, Mr. Chair, you must have a really good credit rating.
Representative Schaffler.
Thanks. You did cover a lot there. But just really quick, there's been a lot about the building industry. And do you have it separated, the data separated out, these complaints, building code violations versus just work not completed? And then my second question is, you talked about the decrease in malpractice due to a change in ownership of this provider. Will that help provide obstetricians providing the service out in rural areas? And then the third one is, you talked about these pawnbrokers, which was in the press quite a bit too, up in Portland especially. Are you working with the police department up there? Because there was some question about enforcement or lack thereof. So I hope you all are getting together on this rather than just everybody going in different directions. So those are quickly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, let me take each of those. With respect to the construction claims issues, the Construction Contractors Board is not within our agency. The Building Codes Division is within our agency, and that does, and you're aware of that, I know, but that does sometimes create some confusion. So we do not maintain the database concerning complaints against contractors. And we also do not have a database concerning code violations because the inspection work is largely at the local level. So one of the challenges of having a system that is divided into many pieces with many different parties being responsible is there is not that central database that citizens may think that there is. So we maintain files on complaints filed against our professional licensees. We license plumbers and electricians and some of the other trade professionals, and if there are complaints that rise to the level of enforcement action against them, we have those records, and I'm going to let Mark talk about that in a little more detail. But the larger database that you may be asking for is not something that we have, and my understanding is there is not, in fact, a database that tracks code violations, because what an inspector would generally do if there is a problem with something not being built to code and having a safety fire life safety issue is require it to be corrected before it's signed off on. Your second issue with respect to medical malpractice, the rate filing was actually filed by Northwest Physicians Mutual prior to the merger being completed. So that filing is based on their frequency and severity issues that they are experiencing right now. And, of course, we review those that rate filing for accuracy as well. The sale is intended and expected to provide benefits in several different ways. One of them is greater access by obstetricians, because Northwest Physicians Mutual did have a moratorium on certain high-risk specialties for new entrants. So that moratorium is being lifted as a consequence of this buyout. Secondly, because the purchasing company is much, much larger and more financially strong, there will be some economies through the ability to self-insure to lower levels. Right now, Northwest Physicians Mutual buys reinsurance starting at a particular level because their financial strength will only allow them to be comfortable insuring a chunk of a certain size. With a financially stronger company, they're going to retain the risk up to a considerably higher level, and that will reduce their reinsurance costs. They're expecting some administrative savings, although they are keeping the local employees and the local management structure so as to provide local service to Oregon doctors. Your third question about pawnbrokers. We have been in contact with the city of Portland concerning what's going on in Portland. Obviously, the FBI does not talk to very much of anybody about what they are specifically doing. But, yes, we do not intend to act in isolation. The issues that we regulate are the financial issues. Pawnbrokers are lenders. They loan money against an item that you bring in, and we regulate how they do that, what fee or interest rate they can charge, what types of notice they have to give you, your ability to buy the item back or redeem the item by paying the amounts that are due. A buy-sell shop could be just a used goods store, and we don't regulate that at all, that is not a loan. If you go in and sell 40 crates of factory sealed widgets to a secondhand shop that buys them from you, period, the police may be very interested in that, but it's not a financial transaction that we regulate. If, however, you are a secondhand shop that says, we will buy this from you, but 30 days later sell it back to you for the same amount plus 20%, that's pawnbroking, and that may be an unlicensed pawnbroker. So our ability to enforce is enforcing the pawnbroking laws. Fencing is a law enforcement issue, but nevertheless, there may be a coordinated use of tools that can address a multifaceted problem. And yes, we are in contact with the city authorities on that.
Great. Any other questions, Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, just a clarification, kind of a follow-up on one of the questions you answered for Representative Schaffler. On this medical malpractice, you're saying the premiums, we're going to see the premiums actually stay level or go down for the first time in many, many years. Is that what the statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes. The average across the board decrease is 8.3%. Now, it varies by specialty, but this is a decrease.
Okay, and then to follow up.
And excuse me, if I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, for this company, that is, we have not seen the rate filing yet from the other major carriers, CNA, or any of the smaller carriers.
So that was where I really wanted to go. So that the original question I think that Representative Schaffler asked was, what I'm curious is, what do you think are the contributing factors to see that decrease in those rates? And it sounded like what you said was just an efficiency of a private insurer that has the ability to offer a program at a better rate than what we've had in the past. Would that be accurate of what your observations are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, no, I think it's more than that. This actual rate filing was based on a decrease in claim frequency. And if you look at the statistics, and again, statistics, you know, you have to look at long-term trends, there was a peak in what we're seeing, at least at the moment, in 2003, and there has been a decline since then. Insurance rates need to both be backward-looking and forward-looking.
Right.
And when a claim is filed, of course, you don't know exactly how much is going to need to be paid out on that claim, so an insurance company will reserve against it. And depending on how claims develop over time, an insurance company may need to increase or decrease its reserve. So it's not a sort of mathematical, you know, this changes today, fewer claims filed this month, therefore rates go down. But and actually, I think nationally as well, there is some sense that the market is softening. Again, I can't make a definitive statement about that, but this rate is based on actual softening of claims data.
Just one more point. I just think it's interesting that we were talking about workers' comp over the last 12 years and things that were done that have allowed those rates to continue to decline or stay flat. And I'm just, it'd be interesting discussion in the future to see, obviously, if medical malpractice could have that same type of results, what things we could do for our healthcare system, mm-hmm. And the availability and doctors to operate more efficient. So just something for the future to have that discussion, I think, would be really important to hear why the rates are going down or what things we can do to help fix those things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the issue of patient safety is a very interesting issue, and one, again, where I think everybody on all sides of the medical malpractice issue agrees that patient safety is a win-win. In fact, this topic just got a little discussion over on the Senate side in the Judiciary Committee yesterday afternoon, I believe. There is a patient safety commission which was set up by the 2003 legislature, which is looking at some of those issues. And malpractice insurance carriers have a great interest in patient safety. And the doctor's company, which is the company that has purchased or is purchasing Northwest Physicians Mutual, has an active patient safety program, as did Northwest Physicians. So things like, I mean, whether it is reduction of infections or you know, mechanisms to ensure that best practices are known and used, there are, in fact, there is discussion going on at the larger level about those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, does the stock market affect health insurance rates and companies to the same degree as it would, say, commercial liability insurance or other insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. We always hear about that the issue of investment returns being very salient in the property and casualty area. And in the health insurance area, health insurance claims tend not to have the feature of being catastrophic. That is, a car insurance premium, you may pay for many years and then have one big claim, so that the insurance company, it has a body of funds that it's investing. Mm-hmm. But I cannot answer that question. I have not heard cyclicality in the healthcare insurance market being tied as tightly to investment cycles as in the property and casualty area. I'd be happy to get back to you on that, though.
Representative Buckley.
Thanks, Chair. Corey, thanks for a great overview, and it's wonderful to find someone in Salem who talks as fast as I do. You had one it makes sense, too. When you talk about the auto insurance, you made one statement about total loss, the issue of total loss. Can you give me a quick definition of that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley. If your car is in an accident, the insurance company will determine whether it is totaled,
right,
meaning that the value to repair it is less than the value of the car prior to accident, and they will not pay to repair. They will pay you the value of the car. And that creates a number of complaints from consumers who believe that their car is worth more than what the insurance company says it's worth. The insurance industry uses a set of proprietary databases to determine that, and it is productive of a fair amount of complaints. And one of the issues, one of the ideas that's in circulation is there a way to make that easier and more have a greater perception of fairness, for example, by using third-party neutral data source, the equivalent of Kelley Blue Book, for example. And there are challenges to doing that because cars have unique features, and often people have an emotional belief in the value of their car. And, of course, the car's value to you as something that you're able to drive around in may be different than its street value if you were to sell it. But because that is an area where we do continue to hear a lot of consternation by consumers, we are looking at whether there's some way to use third-party sources to have a more definitive and less controversial method of determining value.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions of Corey? Yeah, Corey, do you hate to go down and pick up the Sunday Oregonian the last 2 weeks, even though a lot of the issues with the construction contract board are not in your agency, that some of those issues were, and then they followed that right up with the payday loan on the next Sunday?
Mr. Chair, I don't like being bored, and that's not a problem these days. And I would also say that I have a department full of really, really terrific staff, and they spend so much time coming up with good things to do in these areas that it's actually a pleasure to be in this position and to see those articles in the Oregonian.
And the committee, Corey, you mentioned subcommittee of our committee that's looking at the payday loan issue, and they will be making, some of you will sit as members on that also, and that subcommittee will be making a report back to our committee I think sometime in September, isn't that the target date on that is? And maybe this is more of a statement than it is a question, but along that same line, I think part of that same issue that surrounds the payday loan thing is the proliferation of credit cards and the ease of which they are generated. After reading that article on payday loans, I wondered why they would go that direction. Every day you open your mail, there's availability of a credit card. You just go out and use that one, just keep running them up. And I don't know whether that falls within the control of, and the issuance of credit cards falls within your agency and the finance.
Mr. Chair, credit cards are mostly issued by federally chartered institutions, so we don't get as involved in those issues. Credit cards, at least at some level, are underwritten based on credit history, and a payday loan, you do need a pay stub, and you do need a checking account, but they're not otherwise underwritten. So they're for people who have had credit problems or who don't have a strong credit history or who may not have the type of banking relationships that would put them on those attractive credit card lists. Payday lending is very enticing. And it's also immediate. Literally instant. And for people who do not have a lot of financial flexibility and who have immediate need, and the kid gets sick, the car needs repairs. I think we shared with a number of the committees, and I don't know whether this committee has seen it. We did a survey of users of payday lending during the last interim. It was very useful and informative, and in particular the open-ended questions about why did people use payday loans and then what were the consequences. It gives you a real sort of perspective into both the need for and the concerns with this financial product, and we'd be happy to share that. We're providing copies to the subcommittee.
Thank you. That issue, I think, is on the subcommittee, and we'll be hearing more down the road on it.
Some of us don't have wives that stop our credit cards.
Well, I do.
Thank you, Corey. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll switch direction a little bit and have Pat Allen come up and talk to us about regulating fee money. What's that?
That credit card you had going on.
Oh, yeah, I'd give them credit cards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Since it seems just yesterday that either through the session committee on business, labor, and consumer affairs or the general government committee, I was spending a lot of time in front of almost all of you. I won't take a lot of time to talk about what the office does and how it works. What I'd like to do is spend some time updating you on some things that we're doing, report back to you on a couple of efforts that we spent time in session working on, and then answer questions that you might have. I will say that I'll take the implicit challenge from Representative Buckley to prove that I can talk faster than either you or Corey, because I'm going to cover quite a bit of stuff in just a little bit of time. The first thing that I want to want to give you a quick update on, Corey mentioned the legislative package that we had in the last session. I told people, ask after the session, people would ask, well, you know, did you have a good session? I said, I had a great session. The legislature and the governor had a great session in the stuff that I care about, and people always kind of look at me real puzzled because the common perception is, well, it was a long session and all those kinds of things. Just sort of as a recap from the perspective of regulatory streamlining, we came in, state agencies collectively and the governor came in with a package of about three dozen bills to in some way each make regulations faster, cheaper, simpler, easier to understand, easier to comply with without lowering standards. We got most of those bills passed through the session in one form or another, and I'd like to think that we at least helped prime the pump a little bit. Overall, collectively, you all passed and the governor signed nearly 100 bills in the last session to streamline business regulations, again, meeting that standard of making things simpler or easier without lowering standards. You've got, I think, in the packet that we provided you, sort of a one-pager that gives some highlights out of those 100 bills, and they really range from soup to nuts in terms of wide ranges of topics that they cover, tactics that were used, and those kinds of things. And they range from really big issues to lots of small issues where we've taken big problems and worked on little slices of them. But from that standpoint, really, I think a very good session in terms of trying to improve the state's business climate. Second thing I want to talk about, a specific bill that the Session Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs dealt with, had to do with small retailers. You may recall this actually stemmed from a constituent referral from a legislator having to do with all the agencies that someone running a convenience store has to deal with, about 12 different state agencies. If you run the typical Circle K with beer and wine and food and gas pumps and those kinds of things. And we needed some legislative authority that we worked with this committee on to allow us to have some agencies work together on an element of that problem, which was dealing with the multiple license renewal forms and checks and all those kinds of things that came out. And you were able to provide us some legislation that allowed us to move forward on that project and gave us some broad authorization to do other kinds of projects like that. We were able to complete that pilot project, and we learned a lot. Pilot was the word we went in with, and really probably experiment would have been a better choice of words. We took a small sampling of those kinds of businesses and went through an experiment of what would it take to be able to deliver them a single statement that they'd fill out one time and send back once with one check, and we were able to successfully do that. We learned a lot about how difficult it's going to be to make that a broad system that can apply to the 2,400 or so businesses like that, those small convenience retailers. First and foremost is just the huge range of disparity of the technological capability of the various agencies that do those kinds of things. Some agencies are really leading edge in terms of their ability to do very flexible licensing kinds of work. Other agencies in the last session, the Ways and Means process authorized a significant technological upgrade for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which was one of the participants in the process. Prior to the implementation of that, they've got some of their licensing records that are actually hand done on paper index cards and filing cabinets. And when you talk about how do we come up with an integrated system to provide someone a combined license, we've got poles apart in terms of technology. We discovered that was really a significant barrier. One of the tangible things that did come out of that project now is an effort that's now being designed having to do with common customers between Department of Environmental Quality's underground storage tank program and the Department of Agriculture to work on how we can come up with combined licensing there. Even there, we kind of ran into things that we learned that we wouldn't have expected. DEQ licenses underground storage tanks. The Weights and Measures Division of Agriculture licenses pumps that are used to dispense things that come out of tanks for the public. And you think, well, there must be a huge amount of overlap there. Of the same licensee has a tank and obviously a pump to get stuff out of the tank, and there ought to be a lot of common customers. We actually found it was fewer than 25% common customers, because in the gas business, the tank is part of the ground. It's owned by a different business that owns the property than the operator of the gas station, who owns the C-store that sits on top and the pumps and all those kinds of things. So, again, experiment is the right word, because we learned a lot about how the system works and how we can move forward. We're now actively looking at other kinds of industries where there are significant overlaps in the kinds of licensing to see if we can replicate that experiment and try to come up with more of those kinds of opportunities. The third thing to talk about quickly, I don't recall whether we did a demonstration for you last session of our online license directory. It's a system where someone can go in and search by agency, by topic, by keyword, and get comprehensive information all in one place, all in one format about 1,100 or so state licenses, permits, certifications, anything where you need some kind of a state government permission. We're continuing to make sure that system is current. We're doing some updates to improve its usability. But most significantly, it's organized in terms of here are the things you need from state government. Our customers don't think in those terms. They think, here's something I want to do. What do I need to get permits or licenses for? And so what we're now doing is we're working on a pilot project to identify some local governments to participate with us, to include in the material that comes back not just state licensing, but also city licensing, county licensing, and those kinds of things. We right now have agreements that we're proceeding with Wilsonville and Clackamas County, Representative Bruin's district. And we're actively seeking some other local governments, again, trying to find just a handful to figure out are there things that we didn't anticipate in the difficulty of doing that, or issues, so that we can then roll out something that is more broadly a comprehensive way for people to get top to bottom what are the different regulatory issues that they would deal with a particular activity. The last project I want to talk about, you have a very simple document. It's Water-Related Permits Process Improvement Project. Looks like this. This committee didn't touch this issue. It was more the Water and Natural Resources Committees during session. But it's basically the state system of permits that relate to any kind of a project where you're going to impact wetlands, waterways, waters of the state, and those kinds of things. The permitting system that exists to do that now is really, really complicated. And for very good reason. The system exists to protect important public values about water quality, flood control, property rights in terms of water rights, and those kinds of things. And so there's a lot at stake in that system. But the system, nevertheless, is really complicated. You very frequently deal with upwards of 9 state agencies, as many, I think we've counted, as many as potentially 17 different state agencies in permitting a particular project. Lots of customer dissatisfaction, not with the requirements that need to be adhered to, but with the system that you need to go through to be able to find out what you have to do. Time-consuming, 11th hour surprises, all the kinds of things that are sort of prime-time work for regulatory streamlining of how do we deliver the same level of protection, but in a way where you can find out up front what do you need to do and get answers, and not different answers, but answers more quickly or more clearly. A budget note was added to a number of Natural Resource Regulatory Agency budgets last session, asking them to work with our office on a multi-agency project to look at that system top to bottom and see what we can do to fix it. We're working from an assessment that our office helped do early in the May, I guess it was early in the session, as it turned out. that identified about 36 steps that could be taken conceivably to fix the existing system, and then sort of a major recommendation of the system has been created over decades of adding a regulatory program here, an objective there, and it's not a system anybody would sit down and create from scratch. So if you could, what would that look like? And we're working through that process now to figure out is there legislation we may want to come back with next session to try to make the system look like a system rather than a collection of individual agency objectives and permits and those kinds of things. I would just wrap up then with thinking about that project and the combined license project as sort of two poster children for why have an Office of Regulatory Streamlining. These are both issues where lots of agencies have, well, partly it's a little bit like the old joke about a bunch of blindfolded people trying to identify an elephant from the part that they can touch and see what it is. So partly it's a matter of how do you be able to see the whole problem and articulate the whole problem? But even more importantly, it's the issue of nobody in either of those systems owns enough of the issue to be able to say, okay, well, we'll go ahead and take responsibility for gathering all the rest of you up and go fix it. And so I think the value that we're able to provide in our office is that overall system look at what is it the customer experiences and then some responsibility for organizing the efforts and work of other agencies to get them fixed. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions that you might have.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, Mike, hats off to both you and the governor's office for your efforts on the streamlining. I think this has been one of the real bright spots in for the session and your work. You had two questions, if I may. You'd come to my office and we'd talk during the session a while back, and one of the things I remember you saying was that you hoped that your job was short-term, meaning that you hoped that you'd be able to go in and do this and then sort of end this new Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Is that still the mindset in the governor's office? I don't know if I agree with it back then. I thought there might be a permanent place for it, just from a continuous improvement standpoint. But what's the current philosophy
sure,
now?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bruin. I wanted to speak for the mindset of the governor's office. I'd say we're still approaching this from the same standpoint of we don't want to create a permanent part of state bureaucracy. You look at New York's governor's office of regulatory reform. It's been around for 10 or 15 years now. It has a staff of 100 people. It's become part of sort of the government hoops you have to go through to do things. And I'm not sure long-term that adds value. So I think we continue to look at this as a notion of, for a period of time, let's do two things. Let's focus on identifying problems and fixing them, and then let's also work on establishing in agencies, as you say, a culture of continuous improvement around regulation, so that part of what agencies naturally think of when they're looking at regulatory systems is, how can I make them better today than they were yesterday? And that's something that happens because that's the way agencies do business, rather than because I'm, sitting there sending them nasty emails or those kinds of things. And I think we continue to want to take that approach. We certainly envision doing this for a while longer, but there continues not to be a desire to want to make this a permanent part of the bureaucracy.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
A different subject. You've mentioned the myriad agencies and hurdles, if you will, just unique to Oregon to make this all work, and yet we continue to move forward, which is great. As you look around, I don't know if you've had the time or if this has been a directive of your office, but as we look around the nation, who's doing it right, and are there things that we can learn and we can implement here in Oregon, or is it so unique among all the states that we really have to sort of forge this path on our own?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin. We did some initial looking around at who was doing what when we first started. Frankly, a lot of what was out there was aimed at a somewhat different discussion, which was the whole issue of, are regulatory standards in a particular area too high? Cost-benefit analysis of, the cost of regulating an issue or the impact on an industry versus what you get out of it and those kinds of things. And, essentially, we've taken the approach to say that's a policy discussion for the legislative and executive branch to have and come up with those answers. And our approach really is to focus on, once you've established what is it you want to accomplish, then what's the most efficient and effective way to generate that. And I think that approach, as an overall global approach statewide, has been fairly unique. And in fact, the state of Washington, Governor Gregoire's administration created something patterned very closely after our efforts when she came in a position analogous to mine in the governor's office. In their case, really kind of focusing on that same kind of an approach. Now, where we've, I think, had a lot more productive opportunity to go to other states is when we look at particular problems. There are all kinds of solutions out there for different individual regulatory issues. In the area of the water-related permitting, we've looked at some very effective things done in, for instance, in the state of Washington around online systems for how to move that permitting along more transparently for everybody involved and more effectively. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, I guess I would say.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, is there any? We have a large amount of commissions and boards throughout the state with varying, responsibilities and powers. Is there any review or look coming from the your department at these different boards and commissions and looking at maybe consolidating those or making them more effective or more responsive to DCBS or the general public as well?
Sure. Chair Brown, Representative Holby, I would say if the question is are we taking responsibility for redoing the effort, I think back in the Roberts administration, to let's throw all the boards and commissions into a pot and see if we can get rid of some of them or combine them, we're really not trying to do that kind of an approach. What we certainly are doing, though, is working with individual boards and commissions to look at individual regulatory programs that they have, trying to find common opportunities for systems that they can share. Corey Streisinger earlier mentioned License 2000 and the My License software system. Department of Consumer and Business Services has taken the lead in obtaining a statewide an enterprise-wide license for that software, and then she mentioned the user group to create some common tools that agencies can similarly use. And where agencies can work effectively together, we're certainly trying to encourage that. What you do find when you deal with these individual boards and commissions is there aren't any of them out there that are these orphans that nobody cares about. And if you go have a conversation about, really the work of this agency looks a lot like the work of that agency and couldn't they both do it, I guarantee that's the best way to fill a hearing room with people from both sets of constituencies to come in and tell you why it's impossible. Now, this committee did deal with one of those issues, and it was one of the first ones I've seen in a long while, the Board of Investigators, I believe. They actually got to the point where they couldn't charge the licensees enough to pay for the cost of the regulatory program. And in that case, you were able to pass legislation that moved that function. I didn't get rid of the regulation, but it moved the function from an independent board to, I believe it was the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It's one of those things that sounds real logical and real easy, and in practice, I find it a lot more effective to focus on what are the actual things they're doing and are there more effective ways to do those things and leave the organizational arguments as a separate topic.
And, Pat, in that case, that was a very small commission, very small board, And you think, some of the larger ones, how difficult it would be to...
And they didn't come in proposing that they be eliminated, certainly. They came in proposing a package of here's how we can continue to be viable, and it became something different.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much, Patrick, for coming.
I just want to make sure this board stays
off. Let's see. Mark Long. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, I'm the administrator of the State Building Codes Division. I'm here to talk to you about a couple things that we're working on and then see what kind of questions the committee has. Just a couple quick things about our organization. There's some new members on the committee. In your packet, you have a document, Fast Facts, talks about the Building Codes Division. A couple things you might be interested in. In my document, we talk about the fact that the construction industry contributes $5.5 billion to the state economy. That's roughly about 5 or 6% of the overall contribution. Where that, to put it in perspective, last time I checked, agriculture was about 3 or 4%. Finance was 7 or 8%, manufacturing around 10 or 15%, real estate 10 or 15%. So construction related issues, whether it be development, the things that I regulate, employment, it's a big part of Oregon's economy. In the state system, as you can see in our document, how it works is we set the standards, we adopt the code, and then it's carried out through 130 different building departments. Hello, Bob. How are you? I'll just continue on if you're okay. Thank you. There's 130 different building departments out there that help us carry out the inspection and permit services that we set the standards. And then just a little bit more about us. I think Director Streisinger talked about this. We also license trades folks. So we license electricians, plumbers, folks that work in the boiler industry, elevator industry. We have 85 different license types, and I issue licenses to about 42,000 individuals in the state of Oregon, primarily on the trades construction side. Today I want to talk to you about, and I know Bob wants to make some comments, and so I'll turn it over to him, but one of the things I wanted to share with you is give you an update on some of our efforts around electronic permitting. At Building Codes Division, I've got three simple goals for our organization. That's to improve consistency in how the service is carried out, both at our organization but through the 130 different service providers that I work with. To improve customer service, and electronic permitting does that, and to work on improving the compliance program. Some of the things that we're doing that this e-permitting really touches all three of those areas. Having one stop for people to go to get building permit information, I think, is pretty good for helping consistency. For customer service, being able to apply, pay, and receive your approvals for certain building permits online is excellent customer service, available 24/7 using your Visa card. And then compliance. You would say, well, how does an e-permitting system actually help compliance? Well, there's a couple reasons. The current system doesn't provide that, but if you wanted to get data up, as Representative Schaffler talked about violations and what was going on up there, a system could do that. What this system does, though, is it makes buying of permits predictable. And there are times where businesses and individuals are put in a situation of, you know, you get called out on the job, and is it repair or is it new work? And do I take the time to stop the job and go buy a permit? Maybe they're not open. Am I working in compliance or am I not working in compliance? Or can I simply go online and buy the permit and I don't have to make those kinds of business choices depending on what's going on? So it helps in all three of the focus areas that I have at the Building Codes Division, and we're going to provide a demonstration for you of that particular program. But I want to turn it over to Mr. Shipwreck to make a few comments. And then
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And it's kind of related to the Contractors Board data thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, is there any way, and if you don't, is there any way to get data on compliance or lack of compliance and whether or not the builder was the low bidder or not? Because low bidders get jobs for a lot of reasons. Their inability to comply because they don't know any better, lousy materials, and frequently because they don't pay a decent wage and it's on the back of workers. Is there any way you can tell who's not in compliance based on whether they're a low bidder or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't have a way within my shop, and I don't know if they have that information over at the Contractors Board or not. I'd be happy to check with Craig and find out. I don't think they do. That's my best guess. But without checking, I would be a little remiss. So.
Thank you. Morning, Bob.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Member of the committee, I'm Mark Shipwreck. I'm the Secretary of the Oregon Building.
Paul had a question.
I had a question for Mark, but it can wait until after the report.
I'm not going anywhere.
I wanted to come by this morning to follow up on some legislation that we introduced two sessions ago. The industry, both labor and management, got together on a package of bills to help the permitting process and, in fact, all of the economic development activity through building codes, et cetera, in a package of bills in the 2003 session. One of them was the e-permitting issue that Mark was just talking about, and That the legislation is Senate Bill 713, and when we first started out, as just looking at it in the Tri-County area, we had a, and the reason we picked the Tri-County area, in case you're wondering, is we had already done some experiments in some of this type of stuff in the Tri-County area. We already had a process set up, so we expanded it there. It worked really well. And I also want to say this is one of the things that our contractors don't get excited about. A lot of things they're excited about. I've talked to them. They really like this idea. And I wanted the committee to know that. It's worked well. In the last session, we had House Bill 3097. We asked the Building Codes Division to take the Tri-County experiment statewide, which they're in the process now of doing. This is the first step, and we want to go to a statewide e-permitting system. The main reason I'm here this morning is I want to encourage the committee and the legislature to make this pilot program a permanent program at Building Codes and for the state. I can tell you this, in the last year, I've been spending a lot of time. There's been a lot of activity at the state level trying to recruit new businesses to Oregon. And we've been somewhat successful, I must say. I've been talking to folks. I was down in Medford here about 6 weeks ago talking to the folks with Amy's Kitchen. One of the things they ask, though, I've got to tell you, these people, they're all out of state, nice businesses, is how long is it going to take for us to get our permits? It's one of the first things they ask. And I'm getting a call today about something. I'm not quite sure what it is in Roseburg, but that's one of the questions they have is, what's it going to take to get my plant built on schedule? They always have very aggressive schedules. And so this thing is really good stuff. It's good government. It's good for business. And it just helps everyone. And I'll be quiet there. And again, just reiterate that we would like your assistance in seeing this program go statewide. It'd be a good thing.
Well, before we move away from that, those comments, Bob, my intention is to ask a couple of members of this committee to work with the stakeholder group and to get the program implemented. And with that, I'm going to ask Representative Cameron if he'll participate and Representative Schaffler.
Yep.
I got a high vote from both there.
That's great.
Hi.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is turn your attention to the, I believe you have some red folders in front of you, I hope.
Yep.
And we've provided you some specific information on the e-permitting project. And I'd also like to introduce Royce Trammell. He's the person actually responsible for making the system work, works at our department in our Information Resources Division. And we're going to actually put up on the screen a presentation, but I want to, again, point you to the information. There's a document in there. It's the news release. We just recently won federal funding for the e-permitting project, thanks in part to the work of the governor's office and stakeholders requesting this. It's a $250,000 appropriation to help us continue this effort and make this pilot a statewide project, and also provide a template for some regional benefit. I work with a national organization, and they're looking at Oregon as a leader. You talk about what are some of the other states doing. We're one of the first states to look at some of these issues, and I think that press release kind of speaks for itself. Also in your packet is just some stats on the program itself. Our presentation is going to share with you that there are 6 participating jurisdictions right now, but you can see that it's been very active since the end of May. And that speaks for itself. And then just some information about, it's my hope that you can help me, because we're looking for jurisdictions to now go to out of the Tri-County area. I don't know if any of the areas that the committee serves would be interested in bringing this to their local building departments, but this is a document that talks about what needs to happen, and there isn't a lot. It's very easy, and we'll share with that. And then I just have the slideshow for what we're going to be presenting. So for now, I will turn it over to Royce to kind of walk you through, and
we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask this question before you got into this because I'd probably forget if I don't. Building Codes Division, how, you know, how they collect fees, what are those fees used for, and, you know, just trying to get uniform inspection across the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, yes and no. Is there a proactive program of going out and touching each of the 130 jurisdictions? That would be no. Is there a process for having complaints? Yes, and there's really two separate pieces. There's the jurisdiction itself. The city of Salem, since we're in Salem. You know, do you look at the city of Salem or do you look at the individual inspectors that are within the city of Salem? Our activity is more on the individuals because we use a term called certification, but it's essentially licensing the inspectors and officials that work in the local areas. And we just developed standards that went into effect in July this last year for additional accountability of those individuals, and new standards go into place this January for those individuals that require them to follow the state code, to not do drive-by inspections, and I'm not suggesting anybody does, but if that was to happen, we would have that, to meet their training requirements, to provide the code citations that if they're writing corrections, to provide the actual law that they're quoting, those kinds of things. And that whole package or series of inspector issues that we've heard about over the last couple of years, again, we wrote rules that went in July, and then they go in January, and it's basically a complaint, just like we would for a person who has an electrician working out there in the field. We get complaints, we investigate, there's a problem, we take action.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So I understand what you're saying, but then as far as reviewing a building inspection department,
an entity,
because I think there are, you know, laws in place about how they collect fees and what they spend those fees for, but there is no review of that for a local jurisdiction.
Not a, Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, not a proactive review, not an ongoing program. Again, it would be complaint-based, individual-based, but not going out and looking and saying, here's fee issues, here's enforcement issues, here's staffing issues, here's consistency, following the state standard, all those different kinds. There's been discussion about that over the years. There's been a framework that was provided many years ago in 1995 to look at those things. It's like a lot of things in the system, and I don't want to come up here and talk about money necessarily, but there wasn't funding provided for those kinds of activities, so we do it on a complaint basis.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Great. Well, let's turn it over. I'll move the mic. We're going to kind of do this together, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
You bet. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ray.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm excited about this project. This was a great vision and leadership by Corey and Mark to actually make this come about, and a very good challenge for our state staff that worked on it. The website is called buildingpermits.oregon.gov. And it, as Mark said, allows contractors around the city of Portland, which covers quite a few jurisdictions out there, to purchase permits online and get to work right away without having to wait for the process, the normal, you know, approval process. The jurisdictions that participated are listed here: Beaverton, Hillsborough, Milwaukee, and Portland. And then from the county side, Clackamas and Washington. Again, covers large. There's about 500,000 addresses in our database that contractors can buy permits for.
Mr. Chair and the committee, these jurisdictions requested to be part of it. There's not a requirement. These jurisdictions wanted to provide the service to their areas. And so just so you kind of get a context of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a cost to jurisdictions to participate?
It's minimal, and you probably know the details better than I do, but I'll turn it over to Royce. But they simply have to get a bank account so that the money that comes in goes directly into their account because the state doesn't touch it, and then work with our staff, provide address information, but there's no infrastructure or technology work or any or cost or any of those kinds.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. This is the start screen for the site. A service that we provided last year, has been online for a year now, has seen very significant growth. We're selling about 50% of minor labels online now. Permits, which went live in May, we've sold 1,700 to date, but we're seeing a growth of about 14% a week. I hope my PERS account goes up that quickly. But that's a huge growth rate, and we'd really like to see that expand out statewide. I think, you know, just within the jurisdiction that are participating, that's our growth. So we really want to see that expand. This is the screen where the contractor, after they search for the address, gets the options for buying online or for just links to different information, the contact information for jurisdictions or what their website is. But, of course, we're hoping that we can provide ordering online for all jurisdictions around the whole state, and that's our ultimate goal. This touches maybe on some of the questions that you may have. Even though the state is providing the e-pay service, which is difficult for most jurisdictions to get up and running, very few have e-payment online available now. The state can provide that through this site. It doesn't really cost anything. We don't charge the jurisdiction anything. We don't charge the customer anything to use this site. All the jurisdiction needs to do is get, as Mark said, get an account with U.S. Bank. It's under $500, I believe, and they charge maybe.
Representative Schaffler has a question there.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's a great idea, the e-pay. Why just one bank? Is there a reason, a logistical reason for just one bank?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's the bank that we have the account with and at the state. And what happens in this, and we're able to help many jurisdictions. Our discount rate and our banking rates are better than most individual jurisdictions can have because you have the power of the state of Oregon behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's the system that uses, is it ViClicks? Is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
That uses the e-pay feature. And what Royce was talking about, many jurisdictions, because of the complexity, City of Salem does not offer e-pay or Visa, or even take a Visa card as I understand it. Now they're working on that because they have to figure that out for transportation, parks, building. You know, it's a large organization. What this does, we've already figured out the e-pay, checking the credit card, making sure that it's good, checking the license, all that, and we figured out a way to get it into an account that puts it directly into the jurisdiction's banking account. We don't touch the money, it doesn't pass through the state. We don't charge any costs for that. The jurisdiction would, of course, pay the discount rate that you would have to on a Visa, but it's a better rate than every jurisdiction we've worked with so far, maybe other than Portland, has been able to negotiate on their own.
And just a follow-up, please. And just, is it for reasons of just keeping track of it, you only want it in one institution?
If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, the issue you may be getting at is if a jurisdiction has a relationship with an existing institution, that's where they do all their banking with, how can they participate? And what we do is we set up basically a sweep account. So the money goes into U.S. Bank, but it's a sweep that's, I think, the next day, either, I don't remember, it's midnight or whatever, it's swept over to the jurisdiction's account, so it falls into their normal banking processes. So if that's what you're...
So they're not forced to choose that. It's just how the whole e-pay and all that is set up.
They don't have to switch any of their other banking over. Just
thank you.
Goes right in. Okay. As Mark said, there's very few steps that a jurisdiction has to go through to participate. There's no hardware or software requirements. It's all we host it all here. All we need is address data from the jurisdiction and then to get signed up with their bank account and give us their fee structure, and they can be up and running. It's free to the customer. There's a great quote there from one of our key users, Glenn Grossman. Number one thing is that it's all centralized. You're not shuffling papers all day. In the old way of doing things, there was all this faxing, keeping track of all the faxes. No verification that permit applications had been received. It was just a massive amount of time wasted. This is a real bonus for us contractors. I'm no typist, but I can fill out half a dozen permits in literally a matter of minutes, and that used to take hours. And in addition to that, the system will, of course, calculate the fees correctly, which is another issue that we have with the current paper forms, you know, people having to do manual calculations. And then the jurisdictions that we work with get the forms in a typewritten format as opposed to handwritten fax that's hard to read and get into their systems now. So there's a couple other benefits there. This slide was a little hard to put. We wanted to show a map because it's very confusing for contractors currently. If you imagine maybe a jigsaw puzzle map of the state of Oregon, that could kind of serve as jurisdictions with boundaries, but then you have to lay on top of that several other similar maps jigsaw puzzles, if you will, because a jurisdiction doesn't have to assume the program at the city level. It can be at the county level. A county can or city can contract with another city or county to do that program. It's a real mix as to who do I go to if I'm a contractor to get a permit. It's very difficult for them, and this site helps them with that process. It directs that you do an address search. It directs the contractor to exactly the correct jurisdiction, and they're off and running. They don't have to make phone calls and try to figure it out and buy the wrong permit from the wrong jurisdiction, not be able to get a refund, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we were looking at putting this together, the e-pay features and the 24/7, the electronic nature, we thought were the major selling points to the customer. Believe it or not, the address locating feature was the thing that we get a lot of feedback about, and we tried to illustrate that here. You can have situations where you're on a street that goes through multiple jurisdictions, and at one end of the street you might be dealing with a county or a city for your building permits. Across the street or down the street, it could be a completely different one, or in some situations, as we illustrated here, it can be two for the same project. This site figures all that out for the contractor and gets them in the right place. That was obviously something we needed to do, but that's been the piece that we hear feedback anecdotally from the contractors and others that is as important as the ability to do business 24/7 and electronically.
All right. As the next couple slides show, there are a number of different services available online. This is the electrical application. It allows contractors to purchase 18 different services. There's 19 different plumbing services, and there's 20 different mechanical services. And mechanical is furnaces and water heaters and whatnot like that. The customer, after purchasing, gets an email with this form attached to it, which is their authorization to begin work. The cities and counties that are participating all gave us their logo, so that gets stamped in the upper left corner. Customer can begin work right away instead of having to wait for an authorization, and yet the jurisdiction still retains control of actually issuing the permit. So this is posted on the job site, lets the contractor begin work, but if there was a problem, the jurisdiction can yank that or whatever. This is a statistics report showing the breakdown of sales across the different jurisdictions that are participating, different types of permits. In the middle there, you may see that we need to do some work in the plumbing area. There's only been 24 permits sold there. You've been working with industry. I'm not sure. Maybe it's because there's electricity involved with the internet or something. Construction categories breakdown and different work types. We've got all sorts of statistics if you're interested. And these are the organizations supporting this project. Quite a variety and good interest out there. And then contact information if you're interested in more.
Great. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's just a rundown of the system. Again, this is a pilot in six jurisdictions. It is a way to provide consistency customer service, and it actually does help with compliance because we are seeing it's hard to pin this down, but with our sales of minor labels that went electronic and this program, I believe, I can't prove it by data, but I believe people are buying permits in air, because it's easier now, where sometimes they may not have been because of time lags, weekends, after hours, those kinds of things, which then leads to inspections and checking of licensing, a whole variety of the other things, and it makes the system work better when you can help people do their business in a timely manner. I'd be happy to take any questions. In your packet, I've provided some cards that kind of talk about the program. We clipped them hopefully onto the on the information. If not, you can always get a hold of me. I know that my phone number is in a variety of places through the information that you have. We'd be happy to get this out in some of the others. We're looking where to go next. This is in six jurisdictions. We turned the switch on in May, this last May. We hoped that it worked. We've now determined that it works. Our customers, our jurisdictions like it, and we're looking at expanding it statewide, which House Bill 3097, you heard last session, allows us to do that. And I'd like to get it out to other metro areas, but also rural areas of the state, so that you can help bring these kinds of services to areas where people might have to drive a little bit more to get some of their services. They can do this in their home. So if there aren't any questions about e-permitting, I would like to share so you have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. I would like to share a couple other things.
I get to ask mine first. How aware are the cities and counties out there around the state that this is coming down the track? And
well, Mr. Chair, I've spoken to all the staff that work in the cities and counties about this program. We've provided the same presentation at an annual meeting that they're available, and we're just waiting for those jurisdictions to contact us. Again, it's a voluntary program. There's nothing mandated, but it's a service that they can bring to their area. So I believe that most folks know. We work with, as you can saw on the board, the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities. We're just trying to get the word out. And I think that, like anyone else, we talked about it last summer, but it was only a month or two old. I think folks wanted to get us to get a few months under our belt to see if it actually worked. And we're ready to spring this thing loose statewide, and the federal funding is going to help us do that. For this particular piece, there are many other pieces, and what we showed you were the permits that were available and how the system works. But this is not a full interoperable system. This is simply a way to route information, to route data. What industries talked about and other customers talked about is something a little bit more comprehensive that would track data, that would be fully interoperable with the jurisdictions, that would be available statewide, that could do plan review, development of a bunch of other things as well. And I think I talk about that in one of my backgrounder pieces that's in the folder that the department provided you.
Representative Hawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, this is a great program. I really like it. Yeah, I mean, it's going to really help out a lot of contractors out there. Is there any plan to expand this program to other types of permits? We handle electrical and plumbing permits and mechanical permits in here. What about foundation permits or some other types of permits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, yes. My vision, and these are not technology problems. They're relationship and funding issues, and I hope that if you're interested in working with us in industry, we can look at these issues. But it's right now, because it is a web-based routing system, essentially, it's limited to permits that are what you would call over-the-counter, the easy ones to issue, because it doesn't require a plan to look at the job site in relation to other buildings, foundations, those kinds of things. We have talked about this for several years. My vision is that a fully interoperable system, so that people can go to one place, be able to submit plans electronically, get their pay for their approvals, get their approvals online, and get their permits all through a seamless electronic process that then would track inspections. Contractors could find out instantly the status of a particular project. You could track write-ups. I think that would be very useful for not only enforcement but consumer protection issues, but trends. If we're writing up the same thing over and over again or having problems, is the standard the problem? Is it a training problem? Or what is it? Which side of the issue? So that technology's out there. It's a question of cost and how we go about it. And just one thing to think about, and this is why we've been interested at the state, and I touch on it here a little bit. There's 130 jurisdictions statewide that take in $100 million of permit revenue at the local level, okay, on an annual basis, and that's just for building permits. But yet we don't talk to each other electronically, and there isn't a state system. These systems, and I'm just throwing this out there. This is not a hard quote, okay? Because when you get into technology, you have to be very careful. But these building permit systems, each of these jurisdictions that have electronic systems, many don't, spend $1 million, $2 million, $3 million to buy them, and a certain amount of money to maintain them, and they probably upgrade them every 4 or 5 years. It seems to us that you might be able to look at that a little more comprehensively, and I think that's what industry's been talking about.
Bring one question to mind. You know, ideally you want to build something right the first time. You make more money, everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Now, with this data put in, but there's always a problem case out there where people just, for one reason or another, they can't, they're ornery, or they just do it the old-fashioned way. They have a problem complying with their building inspector. Will this data show who are these problem cases and who is regularly, consistently having a problem complying with the building code? Because I think that's a red flag for the consumer to say, well, this individual consistently has a problem complying with building codes. I think I'll go elsewhere and shop. Is that going to be available too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, no. None of the things that we've showed you today provide that level. That's kind of a far-reaching kind of vision that hopefully, if you establish a committee, we can talk about those kinds of things. And then there's two separate pieces to that. There's the actions that occur under the contractor's board over workmanship and meeting the contract requirements and those kinds of things. And then there's the code piece. I think we need to talk about how to look at those issues. From my standpoint, because I adopt the statewide code, I train the inspectors, okay, and if we're seeing repeat problems, then is it a code standard, is it an inspection standard, but also your point, should we be able to target those things? And I think that would take broader connection between my organization and CCB to look at that.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me just say amen. My other job, as I call it, my mortgage paying job, is for a large commercial contractor in Portland, so this is absolutely beautiful. My question to you is, though, how is this being advertised to the contractor community? I understand the question about how we're advertising this to the various your clients, if you will, the localities, the cities, and the counties, and whatnot, but how is this being brought out to the ultimate client, which is the contractor, advertised?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Brown. We've advertised through the associations. You can see the participating associations that we work with, and we've sent numerous press release documents, one-page documents. Again, when we're at the point, at least with this particular system, that we feel it works, we know what we're doing, and it's successful, and we want to talk about where to take it to the next step. I look at this as riding a moped. Okay. The next step is probably, some kind of Chevrolet and then maybe a Cadillac to really get into full development issues. But we have advertised the press release. We have the website. We work through the associations. And obviously, we haven't done a very good job with the plumbing community, and I'm going to redouble my efforts there to get folks involved. We were a little bit tentative in the beginning, frankly, as I said, because make a lot of, you have a vision, you have plans, you work hard, but you got to turn the switch on. It's got to work, and it's got to be good for the customer, not just good for us. And we think this program is, so you'll see us get out there. I hope by doing this presentation, you'll help us. Give you my cards. We will go anywhere and talk to anybody about this anytime. Developers, contractors, jurisdictions, you name it, we'll be there. We'll make it work.
I can add sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Brooke. We've also been working with the jurisdictions that are the participating jurisdictions to put materials on their permit center counters so for the contractors that come in, they can see, there is a website out there that I can go do this. We've also been encouraging the jurisdictions to put information on their websites linked to us so we have that online for people that are searching online. And we're making sure that we'll show up in, like, Google search, that sort of internet search, anybody out there looking for permits, we'll show up through that method, too.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for your presentation. I just, looks too good to be true.
No, seriously.
Everybody's, all these accolades about the system, and obviously there's a couple of customers here. One is the municipalities that are issuing these permits and to help them become more efficient, sounds like, right, mm-hmm. obviously. And the second one would be the contractors that are actually applying for these permits. I just wrote down a question. What's the resistance? What's the catch here that, the too good to be true question that is going to slow this thing down or people resist getting on the bandwagon to be in this program? What's the resistance that you foresee?
Representative Brown, Representative Cameron, for this system, I'm not sure I'm seeing resistance, just caution, okay? I think that it would be fair to say when the state runs around and trumpets a particular program and says this will make it better, faster, cheaper, that some folks might be a little cautious at first. Okay, I think that's accurate. And so we worked with six of the jurisdictions that do a majority of the business in the state as far as development and whatnot. If it needed to work there, if it's going to work anywhere else. So I expect with your help and our advertising and working through League of Oregon Cities that we'll get jurisdictions wanting to do this because I think it's what state government should do. I mean, we're providing the mechanism, the infrastructure. We don't collect the money. All routes there. They still have control of the permits. So I don't know that I see resistance. I just see folks being cautious to make sure that it worked. And I guess if you hear that from me, We're doing a lot of things on web-based and changing technology, but I like to get in there, plan for the future, get it to work, and then go around and talk to you about what we're doing as opposed to what we're going to do. So I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, just to follow up, it'd be good in the future to have some municipalities here and some contractors that aren't, you know, participating, and I'm sure you've done some presentations, and just to hear what they think or what's maybe holding them back or potential drawbacks for them, so we can address that. And we'll probably get a chance to do that in our subgroup as we look at it.
Yeah, and then just another thing to keep it in context, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, up until this last session, and I'm not even sure when the bill went into effect because I can't remember every one of them, this was limited to the Portland area, and it was a pilot. You, through this committee and the legislature, expanded it statewide just this last session, and I don't know if it was an emergency clause or it goes in January. I don't recall. So it is still pretty new on the statewide application.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, you're getting a lot of questions. Maybe one other. I know that one of the big issues that I hear out there is how long it takes to get a building permit. It just takes forever. And, you know, you turn your plans in, get plan review, and get all that, and it just takes a long time. And I think there's a lot of misconception out there about what it takes to get a permit. And the fact is that it's just not the plan review and the actual building permit that we're talking about. They have to wait for the fire marshal, and they have to wait for land use review, and they have to wait for all these different reviews before you can get a permit. And the finger usually comes back to the plan review staff. Mm-hmm. Is there, and Pat Allen, I think, stepped out, but I'm just kind of curious if there's any look at that whole system of trying to get that system to work a little bit closer together and faster or simultaneously instead of waiting for one to get done before you get the next. And, when permits take 6 months, sometimes. And I'm just wondering if there's a look at that in the permit system as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, we look at that. We try to share best practices with the jurisdictions, but you're exactly right. The building department is seen as the gatekeeper for a variety of other services and regulations that are carried out at the local level, whether they be land use, environmental, transportation. That all ties into development, and then the plans examiner is kind of the router of all that. I believe that if we can figure out a way to, through an electronic process, standardize those issues, standardize the requirements, like we did with one of the things that we did with this, and believe it or not, it took quite a bit of time, is just get the list, the 18 or 19 building permits that you saw, I can't remember, 18 electrical, 19 plumbing. It took a significant amount of time when we were putting this together with jurisdictions just to get, okay, y'all offer this one's right. This is how you do it. And we say, no, we give 50 feet of pipe for $25. And the other one does 100 feet of pipe for $25 or whatever it is. Working out all those issues allowed these permits to go quicker, and it standardized it. I think as we get into this committee, we'll be able to look at, because what I'd like to do is to get to electronic plan submission, which means you'll start standardizing those issues, coordinating those issues, and then have the ability at the local level, if it works properly, to parallel so that the building plan review can go on at the same time as some of the other ones, so that it's not sequential, which then takes so long. So we're working on it, but it's a ways out there.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much, Mark, for coming today.
I would like to talk about the task force a little bit, if you have just a couple minutes.
You bet.
And I want to hand out. Thank you, Royce.
An updated document for your.
Mr. Chair, I think Director Streisinger talked about the Construction Claims Task Force, and I'm just passing out an updated document that's in your packet. The difference is just the proposed agenda, timeline, and schedule, so that you can see kind of what we've done, what we are doing. This is a legislative-created task force, House Bill 2078. It was later on in the session that the bill was put together. It is a 9-member panel. that's been appointed by three different state agencies. Just to give you some quick information, to date we've received over 100 documents for us to review as far as recommendations, best practices, looking at other states. We have a website that we're very proud of. You know, a lot of folks have a website, but this, people can go into the website. You can sign up in the website to get direct email every time we make a change in a particular area in the task force. We have over 200 individuals signed up. We have the work plan that we talked about, and we already have, in the 3 months that we've met, over 30 different recommendations coming in from the experts, and they can be characterized into probably five or six different issues. Consumer protection, issues around the construction contractors board, contractor requirements, what does it take to be a contractor, building codes, the things that I do, design standards for the architect community, training and education requirements, and then best practices. You can see, if you look at our meeting schedule and our timeline, we've had three meetings to date. Our kickoff meeting, we opened up the floor to consumers who came in and talked about a wide range of problems they were having in the construction community, several hours of testimony. And then in November, we brought in what we call building science experts. We had folks travel in from Tennessee, Canada, from within Oregon and other states to share their experiences on a national level, what they're doing to solve these problems. We had an overview of the CCB process and the design community process earlier this month, and then you can see we're going into owners, developers, looking at construction issues, clear down to, and this is really the first phase. Second phase will be the insurance issues that we'll pick up in July. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have about the task force, what we've done, what we're doing, provide updates, whatever you'd like, Mr. Chair.
And so at the end of the day, when you get all the way down past this June 28th, you're going to have some recommendations and proposals to come back to the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the law requires us to provide a report to the legislature by, I think it's January 31st of 07. And this is just phase one. This is not complete. This is just over the construction design contractors board's issues. Then we'll go into looking at the insurance equation to this. And then around September, we'll start drafting our report that I can share within my target is to have the final report done by December. It has to be due by the end of January 07. So, but I'd be happy to provide updates as we kind of go along.
Move through the process.
Yeah. It's a multi-agency effort. We're looking at all the issues of insurance, energy, building codes, construction contractors board in this one group. I got to tell you, we've had a great deal of interest in this, a lot of participation, and I'm very hopeful that there's going to be some very good recommendations that will come to the legislature, and we'll make some change.
Okay. Any questions on this, Mark? Again, thank you very much, and Representative Cameron and Schaffler can work with you and through your office and with this work group on the e-permitting.
Okay, I'll work through the Spanish and.
Yep.
Okay, that's okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you again very much. Moving right along, Lisa Trussell, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Lisa Trussell, and I represent the members of Associated Oregon Industries. And a lot of what I was going to cover, some of which has already been covered by Corey Streisinger, so I'll just be very brief. I wanted to just give you an update of some of the issues that my members are concerned about and working on or monitoring during the interim. First of all, I'll start with the Employment Department issues. You may recall, I think it was in 2003, we passed a bill that would clarify that if you're fired for violating your employer's drug and alcohol policy, you wouldn't get unemployment benefits. And we've had a couple of years now of interpreting that law and watching what's happening on cases where there's been a termination such as that involved. And the employment department is working with us on a couple of things. One is they're taking a look at their rule, the rules they implemented to conform with that statute, to see if there's anything that needs to be addressed by rule. The second thing is that we're looking at cases that my members brought forward that actually had been adjudicated. And we're finding that some of the problem is, quite simply, the employers didn't understand what the elements of a drug testing policy were, or they didn't have a proper written policy. So on that one, they had thought they were okay, but they really weren't, didn't comply with the law. The other thing we're finding is that the initial adjudications in the employment department, when there's been a drug testing policy that was complied with, the initial decision at the employment department has been what my members think was the correct decision. They denied benefits, and then it's been on the appeals at the hearings unit that those have been overturned. So we're kind of looking at what's causing those to be overturned at the hearings division. So I'm very confident that we'll be able to address this issue cooperatively with the department, and they've been very willing to work with us on it. The other thing related to the employment department that we're watching and with interest is Debbie Lincoln will be retiring December 31st. So we're interested in who will be appointed to replace her. I think that you'll recall the independent contractor bill. But on that, on a positive note, they've been working on the website that they talked about developing so that the agencies would link up. If you typed in independent contractor, you would get the same information regardless of which agency you were trying to find information about. And they've got a test page done, and you'll probably be hearing more about it, but the test page that they sent out for some of us who are interested to take a look at, it looks good. There obviously has to be some tweaking on it, but I think that that's something that will be a very positive tool for both employers, people who want to be independent contractors, people who would rather be employees. I think it'll be good information for people to have on that. So we're watching that development, and we're very pleased with the efforts they've made thus far. Another major issue for our employers is workforce development, and particularly amongst our manufacturing members, whether they're in food processing, metals, wood products, whatever, the manufacturers have a keen interest in workforce development. So our AOI has been working with Lita Colligan from the governor's office, Oregon Business Council, and our members who are interested in workforce development to try and get a better understanding of the issue, what our members' concerns are. And since we're not a trade association, we have a wide variety of membership, and workforce development means different things to different industries. And what the resources are, because there's a lot of resources out there, but employers may or may not be aware of them. Larger employers typically are aware. Less smaller ones may not be. So that's an issue that we're getting more involved with. Julie Brandis is kind of the point person on that, and I'm her backup on that issue. The other issue that we're concerned about with workforce funding is with workforce development is the funding issue. And where's the where would the money for continuing workforce development come from? There's going to be a task force that the governor has invited me to sit on that will look at if you're going to use unemployment trust or unemployment insurance funds for that, what would be the criteria for diverting funds before it goes into the trust fund? And that would apply to workforce development or other issues as well. So that's something that we'll be involved in. And even amongst initial reactions amongst our membership varies about whether the unemployment insurance money is the appropriate funding source or not. Some think it's a great idea, and others aren't so sure it's a good idea. So I think that there'll be a lot of those issues discussed during the governor's task force. Workers' comp has already been touched upon. I continue to represent our members on the Management Labor Advisory Committee along with Mr. Shiprack. And there's a couple of subgroups that have been formed to deal with. One was the sunset issue. There are certain parts of the statute that are set to sunset, and if you've ever looked at the workers' comp statute, it's a nightmare because where does it roll back to if we don't let this language? It doesn't flow nicely. It doesn't read well. So we're looking at the sunsets and whether they're necessary. You know, which ones we want to continue. Which ones have we had enough experience with that we don't need it anymore? Because practically speaking, everything sunsets in 2 years because you guys come back. So what's good today may not be good tomorrow. So anyway, we're looking at some of those issues.
Lisa, that you're talking about the reforms, the Millennium Hall?
Well, they've been changes since the reforms. A good example is permanent partial disability payments and how we structured those. They're set to sunset. Oh, well, next session it has to be acted on. I can't remember called exactly the date, but it would roll back to how we used to do it. But those changes were actually made 97 or so. Those were later on how we did that, where we pay based on people get compensated more for their disability as it relates to work rather than just the disability. So that's one that they're looking at. The other thing that we're going to be looking at is last session, the alternative care providers, i.e. the chiropractors as wanting back in as attending physicians. The 2003 session, we expanded nurse practitioners. There were all sorts of bills for other people who had been attending physicians prior to the 1990 reforms, all promising to do good things and wanting back in. There will be, MLAC will be looking at analyzing the impacts of allowing the various providers back in as attending physician. And I think I testified before this committee that, you know, we believe that the way we set up the workers' comp system with the restriction on if you're an out-of-managed care organization provider, there's limits on you. But if you're an alternative care provider who's hooked up with a managed care organization, you can be an attending physician. So at the time that those bills were before you, well, we weren't aware of any complaints from workers that they were unable to access the care they felt was appropriate to them, nor were we aware of any providers who had been denied access to managed care organizations carte blanche by type of treatment they performed. So that's something that will be looked at during the interim. And then Corey mentioned the medical quality initiative, which we're very interested in because it's probably appropriate to take a look at what could happen with medical costs if we're not paying close attention because we've seen what's happened with health care. And I would agree with Corey that the best care is not necessarily the cheapest, which was the whole concept that we discussed at Mahoney Hall when the managed care concept was being discussed. There was not an implication that we wanted cheap care. We want good care, appropriate care, and sometimes that care costs more. But if you're only going to replace a knee one time instead of two or three times, you're still money ahead. So that's the sort of issues that we're looking at. The other thing, which sometimes your committee has input on, and sometimes not, but I think it's on everybody's mind, and I attended a summit yesterday where Representative Cameron was, but it's my members are very concerned about the cost of health insurance, and we'll be looking. We have a separate committee on health policy that will be taking a look at some ideas for the next regular legislative session. And that's what I'm doing right now.
Representative Schaffler.
Thanks. How many workers, Lisa, have been fired for not complying with their companies? Excuse me. Have been fired and not been given, granted, or let up go unemployment insurance benefits because they were not in compliance with their alcohol and drug, their employer's alcohol and drug?
I don't have a number. I'm sure the department would, based on what they've adjudicated, but I don't have that.
Okay. Any other questions?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, one last thing, which made me think of. The House last session twice passed a bill that would address how we handle medical marijuana in the workplace. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it through the Senate, and time just ran out on us. We are watching what the Supreme Court does. They had oral arguments a month or so ago to see what how that will be interpreted. And the other thing that didn't get much attention last session but is potentially a concern is that when the appellate court looked at the Washburn decision, which was the medical marijuana case, they had an interesting interpretation. Under federal disability law, if I wear glasses, I need glasses. If I wear glasses and I can read with my glasses on, I'm not disabled under federal law. But that may or may not be the case in the state of Oregon. So there may be two issues related to that, depending on what the Supreme Court ends up deciding on the Washburn case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa, you handle insurance issues mostly in addition to your other ones as well?
Yes, I handle health policy.
Health policy, okay. Thank you. I had a question about commercial liability.
Yeah. Right. Me. Not your gal.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions, Lisa?
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. Pam Lovett.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's good to see all of you here in December. I am Pam Lovett with the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and I have some written testimony I'm going to give to you, and I'm just going to be brief. I have an issue I want to touch on that we're going to be focused on over the interim that I think you'll all be interested in. First of all, there are 92 credit unions in Oregon, both federally and state chartered, with $11.6 billion in assets and 1.4 million members, and we employ over 4,000 Oregonians. Our smallest credit union is Northeast Oregon Federal Credit Union in Elgin, Oregon. They have 310 members, and our largest credit union is Portland Teachers Credit Union, chartered in 1931 with $1.9 million in assets and 164,000 members. There's some general information on credit unions, on philosophy and background, and also our cooperative structure. I just want to talk a little bit on the legislative side. Last session through this committee was House Bill 2578, and it was a cleanup to the Oregon Credit Union Act. We go through our act every 2 years and try to make it a law that is helpful so that credit unions can serve Oregonians well. The other bill that did not go through this committee, which is priority, was Senate Bill 748, and it relates to financial education, which is, I think, an issue that all of you are very concerned about. Our bill asked that the Department of Education create a financial education curriculum and adopt it and encourage schools to use it. Another bill that two of your fellow colleagues in the House introduced mandated financial education, and those bills were both heard and moved, but both died in the Ways and Means Committee. Credit unions are very interested in the very broad issue of financial education. Financial education can mean seniors, can mean financial education for low-income individuals. We tend to focus, credit unions have focused on financial education in the schools. We have adopted, and there's some information, it's called the NEFI program, the National Endowment for Financial Education. And they are financial education materials that we can either go in and train teachers with or provide for schools to teach financial education. You may or may not be aware that is not a required course anymore in our high schools. I know that when I was a senior in high school, maybe it was a freshman, I was required to take a personal finance class, and I think it helps get you on your way. So many of our personal issues in life, buying a car, getting a mortgage, planning our own budgets in our households, requires an understanding, and I provided some survey data that our youth are not understanding of financial education as much as they should be. I think if you look at the use of payday and title lenders, high bankruptcy rates in our state, in the western states, and also financial fraud, people having taken advantage of their finances, can go back and relate to just some general financial education. So I think that over the interim, our credit unions are going to be very focused on this issue. We're looking to put together a forum. There's so many wonderful programs. Banks have great programs. CPAs have wonderful programs. The Junior League has a program. Senior groups, AARP has financial education. We are working with the state and DCBS on a task force related to consumer financial education, where we're trying to bring all this information together. Everybody's out doing their own thing because the state's not requiring our youth to have this course anymore. We need to get everybody on the same page and have some basic training. We would like a model, some sort of curriculum adopted, but I'm not sure if Department of Education agrees with us on that. So I think even though the education curriculum piece goes through another committee, I think this committee should be very interested in the broad issue of identity theft, financial education, financial fraud, and we certainly want to be partners with you on that. Finally, we are asked to serve on the payday lending committee or participate in that, and I've talked to the chair. Credit unions, as many of you know, are offering an alternative to the payday lending product. It is a short-term loan product, and last time I surveyed our members, and I'm going to do this before our meeting in January, but there were over 30 credit unions that offered these short-term products. The average loan is about $300, and they range from an 8% to 18% annual compared to 390 to 520 for some of the payday lenders. In a credit union, you don't go and turn over a paycheck. It is a short-term loan product. The state saw that the credit unions could provide this product, and it was a great place for them, especially as our community charters grow and serve broader communities. We can fill a niche, and many of our credit unions have been doing these short-term products for years and years. They never called them payday loans. And I was talking to some of our staff who worked on these loans, and they said, although we don't want to be associated with that industry and call them, people won't come to the credit union unless we call it a payday loan. So a lot of them have some sort of payday loan name in the product. So we're trying to provide, we need to get this product out and get consumers aware of it, but we'll be talking to your subcommittee more about that in January.
Thank you, Pam. Representative Chaffler.
Thank you, and Pam, I'm glad you're going to be there. I'm glad to have the honor of being on that committee.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you guys should get those big signs up. Seriously, though, I think, and I hope we, as a legislature, need to address this. There's a lot of things we can do in this. The best cure to this problem is getting folks the opportunity to take care of themselves financially. And that includes a good job. There's a whole bunch of stuff we can do that some people on the left don't agree with and others the people on the right don't agree with that would allow us to do that. And that's where we're failing. To make it, if we could probably put it, this may well be put on the initiative solving this problem for us, and how you want to look at it. But I don't think we're doing enough to get people a good, decent job in this state. And that means taking advantage of our natural resources, building more America, more power generation, more roads, and greater education opportunities. That's the problem in this state. But I'm glad you're going to be there, and I'm just so honored to be on that committee, Mr. Chair. I just can't put it into words. So I just had to get that speech in
here. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam, it's wonderful to hear that the credit unions are offering a product that can replace or stand side to side with these payday loans. My question is, first I'd heard that that was really available. My question is it truly apples to apples? It's wonderful that the credit unions can offer something between 8 and 18% versus whatever the, I mean, usury rates that we're hearing about, these 300% sort of deal. But is it truly apples to apples, or has that been determined yet? Can somebody with no credit, basically, as how I understand people are getting payday loans, can they access this liquidity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the people that are accessing these are individuals who are in a financial need for a short-term, you know, loan product. Are people coming off the street to the credit unions and getting these? I can't answer that. I think that initially, because honestly, a lot of the more visible programs started just a few months ago, and that's why I need to get some more data from my members. I think it was existing members, but as the program grows, and especially as credit unions are able to serve broader communities, and, you know, the article in the paper, you know, we sent a note to the reporter, we want to do a follow-up to make sure that he knows about the products that we're, you know, offering to get that out to the public. But it is an apples-to-apples product. It is if a individual is in need for quick cash on a short-term basis, that's the kind of loan. Some of our credit unions do offer that, or do require that you have some sort of account set up, but you don't turn over a paycheck like you do at a payday lending operation.
Can we follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
How are these being secured?
They're being secured by, first of all, not all of them are. Some of them will be secured by an existing account, but not all of them are being secured.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Dan?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today. Thank you. One of the things that, as you become a chair of a committee, you find out that your staff people like to throw these things up to you. And on one is pronouncing names. Janet, I'm quite sure, looks at the phone directory and tries to find one with the longest name. And so we'll try it this one. Mr. Drew Neonopoulos. How close did I get?
Perfect.
Right.
Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Drew Leonopoulos, rhymes with Minneapolis. I am an assistant attorney general, and I, for the last 5 months, have been the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. Our office is located at 1162 Court Street Northeast in Salem. The Financial Fraud Section is a part of the Civil Enforcement Division in the Department of Justice. We're the civil law enforcement arm for the state. The makeup of our section is set forth in the organizational chart, which I have included in the materials that I believe you should have in front of you. Basically, we're 9 lawyers, 5 investigators, support staff, and a host of volunteers who man our consumer protection telephone hotline. Basically, our mission is fairly straightforward, and that is to enforce Oregon's consumer protection laws. We have 2 goals in carrying out that mission. First, to enhance consumer confidence in marketplace transactions. And second, to promote a level playing field for businesses, fair competition, to ensure that businesses are following the law when they market real estate goods and services. The mission statement of our section is, again, set forth in the written materials which I've provided you. We accomplish our mission basically 2 ways. First, education. Second, enforcement. The first prong. Educating businesses and consumers. We track marketplace trends through several sources, including written complaints, calls to the AG's consumer hotline, in an effort to identify businesses who are engaged in patterns and practices of unlawful behavior. In 2004, for instance, we received almost 11,000 written consumer complaints. So far in 2005, we're tracking about the same, approximately 10,500 to date, with several weeks left to go. calls into our consumer complaint hotline. 2004, approximately 54,000 calls into the hotline. We're down a little bit in 2005, over 46,000 calls so far. I have included in your materials, I believe the last attachment from 2004, our top 10 complaint list. So you can see the top 10 areas of business in which we are receiving our consumer complaints about. Our educational efforts are basically premised on the notion that a well-informed public and a well-informed business community are less likely to fall prey to deceptive marketing practices in case of the consumers, and less likely to engage in those practices in case of the businesses. We believe education is an effective method of prevention and is a lot more cost-effective than enforcement and litigation. But when education fails, enforcement is the next prong of our mission. And we do bring enforcement actions. The primary tool that we use to bring those enforcement actions is Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We bring actions to stop violations of unlawful trade practices and antitrust acts, to restore consumers to positions they were in before the unlawful acts, and to shift the cost of our enforcement actions onto the offending businesses. Our section is charged by statute with enforcing Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And again, that act governs basically how businesses advertise and sell goods, services, and real estate to consumers in the Oregon marketplace. The consumer protection laws apply to a wide variety of marketplace transactions. For instance, motor vehicle sales, services by healthcare providers, telecommunications, pharmaceutical manufacturers. The laws apply regardless of whether the transactions take place in person, over the phone, or through the internet. Again, under our consumer protection laws, we are empowered to seek injunctive remedies designed to change the business practices, obtain restitution for injured consumers, and to recover the costs of our enforcement actions. And we often partner with public agencies and private organizations who share our mission. And again, by bringing enforcement actions designed to stop the unlawful conduct. We also provide assistance to consumers. This is more back on the education side. Assistance to consumers who contact us primarily via the AG's Consumer Protection Hotline. We have what we call enforcement officers who kind of work to mediate individual consumer complaints and resolve those complaints, hopefully to the satisfaction of the consumers and the businesses alike. A lot of those cases are kind of isolated incidents or isolated problems rather than pattern and practices of unlawful conduct that we quite often look to escalate into an enforcement action rather than simply trying to resolve the consumer's individual complaint when they call it in to us. We work cooperatively with regulatory agencies, but it's important to note that we're not a regulatory agency. We are a civil law enforcement agency, and our missions are are distinct from regulatory agencies in that regard. Regulatory agencies, for instance, ECBS, are charged with overseeing conduct of professions or occupations for which the state has established licensing or registration requirements. Again, administrative agencies regulate those type of businesses. They issue licenses and may revoke those licenses or take action by refusing to review, to renew, or to suspend those licenses or permits. But generally, regulatory agencies aren't empowered to provide restitution to injured consumers. There are certain exceptions to that. Again, we do work cooperatively with many regulatory agencies, and we when the conduct of a business's action falls beyond the reach of a regulatory agency, we are often then kind of brought into the picture and can move the ball forward when a regulatory agency is maybe out of options. I have listed a number of regulatory agencies that our agency, Department of Justice, has worked with and have set forth some examples of the type of actions that we work on with those regulatory agencies in the written materials I provided. For instance, we work with the Construction Contractors Board, CCB. We've worked with the Health Division, Oregon Department of Transportation, Oregon Department of Agriculture, and again, I've listed some examples of some of the type of actions that we have worked in a cooperative fashion with those regulatory agencies. One of the important roles that we serve in financial fraud consumer protection is the ability to track trends in consumer protection issues. We track those trends, again, through the tens of thousands of calls annually that we receive from consumers complaining about business practices, and through our coordination through the National Association of Attorneys Generals with our counterparts in the 49 other states and territories. We also are very much plugged into what's going on in some federal agencies. We often coordinate with the Federal Trade Commission in actions, and again, we share data back and forth concerning trends nationally in consumer protection issues. Each February, we list our top 10 consumer complaints for the prior year. So we're a couple months away from doing that. Over the last 5 years, telecommunications has topped the list of consumer complaints that our office has dealt with. Thanks. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Question Schaffler.
Thank you. It looks like the Internet's catching up with telecommunications, though, by the looks of these numbers. And then these are just the complaints. I'd like to see data that turned out to some, the investigation actually turned into some kind of legal action on your part, if you have that. And then are the payday loans, which can be people call car title loans, the same thing, is that under the consumer lending? Would that be under consumer lending then? Would that be payday loan?
Yes, Chair Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, yes, it would be.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Senator Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. On page 4, there's a note about House Bill 2424 and Senate Bill 2208, which we've restored the ability to take action against telemarketers who violate the Do Not Call laws. My question is, does your agency have a plan to present to us a agenda for 2007, a wish list of bills, and will it include another effort to restore your ability to go after the telemarketers?
Chair Brown, Representative Buckley, we are currently in the process of developing our legislative agenda for 2007. It's certainly possible that that will be on there. Those are decisions that the Attorney General makes, and we're just in the process of developing that agenda right now. So that's a long-winded way of saying I'm not sure, but it's certainly a possibility. It's on our radar screen.
Great. Can you follow up?
Follow up.
Thanks, Chair. Can I also ask then, be it this on the radar screen or not, the number of complaints I've received in Southern Oregon about gas prices, and I'm wondering if that's going to make the top 10 this year, or what your department's role is in investigating the difference in prices in the state of Oregon.
Chair Brown, Representative Buckley, we have actually, through our antitrust unit, we have looked at those issues, and we are kind of coordinating nationally with attorneys general in other states to look at those issues. They are gasoline pricing is very much a concern of the attorney general. From what I've seen, I can tell you it appears to be an extremely complex pricing system that they are working under.
It's a very diplomatic way to put it. Thank you.
Can I use that the next time someone calls? Representative Crump.
Yes. Cameron. Drew, thank you for being here and updating us today. Just on this list of the top 10 consumer complaints, there's about 4,700, but in your testimony you mentioned tens of thousands of calls. So how does a complaint get to this, kind of follow-up to Representative Schaffler's here, how does a complaint actually get to this 4,700 list? Like you have 1,600 under telecommunications, and it'd be interesting not only how does it get here, how many actually end up you take action on, but a comparison to the number of complaints in these industries to the number of possible transactions that are going on also might be some good information, because even though telecommunications is the top versus, you know, automobile dealers, there's probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of transactions. I mean, each one of us here has how many telephone bills that we deal with every year or every month. So I know I asked you a lot of information in there, but how does a complaint get to this list would be my first question.
Yes. Chair Brown, Representative Cameron, the in order to make it onto our top 10 list, first we are talking about the complaints need to be reduced to writing, and oftentimes the complaints that we get through the hotline for a variety of reasons are not turned into formal written complaints. It may be that the consumer calling simply got their question answered or was flat out wrong about something, just simply may not have wanted to pursue the matter any further, or was just seeking information about a certain. So the calls to the hotline are not necessarily a great indicator of kind of what's going to make it onto our top 10 list. But we did have, again, approximately 11,000 written complaints in 2004, and a similar number for 2005.
Written?
Yes. Complaints that were actually reduced to writing.
So just to follow up then, so that means that there was, this is the 80% or, well, we got 40, we got 50% of the claims are in the top 10 categories, and the others would be in much smaller categories. Maybe there's only a category of 10, with 10 in it or something like that, to get to that 11,000 mark.
Yes, Chair Brown, Representative Cameron, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions? Let's see. Thank you very much, Drew, for taking the time this morning to come and have with the presentation.
Thank you very much,
Appreciate
Chair,
it.
Members of the committee.
And committee, we've worked our way down through the presenters this morning. The people here, again, I want to thank everyone that came in with the presentation this morning. And this gives us a quick overview of some of the issues that we deal with in this committee. And Janet prepared a list of some of the major bills that we worked with in last session. I think if you look down through that, literally it was everything from soup to nuts that we had and all the different issues. And and then talking about our work plan for the interim, Janet's going to pass it out now. There's a lot of issues that we'll find on this that we dealt with last time. We'll have a reappearance on our agenda, but it definitely doesn't limit us to this. And I would welcome input from any of the members of the committee. If there's issues or concerns that you want us to bring up and talk about in our meetings during the interim.
Mr. Chair, as the chair of the subcommittee on committee loans, I haven't heard anything about scheduling or...
I think that she's working on that now. I don't know. I assume that the speaker's office is probably... will be the final word on the number of meetings and when they take place. And so apparently that's not out yet. Is there anything else that the committee has this morning? Thank you again for your attention, and I thought it was a very good meeting and a good start. Looking forward to the interim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other issue I would see, if I can make comment, is on the consumer protection aspect of the work, things like the telemarketing and whether we even want to delve into gas prices, but if we have time for discussion, further discussion on consumer protection.
Okay. I would ask that you make contact with Janet, okay, with the specifics of what you'd like to where you'd like to go, what you'd like to talk about.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, I can answer a question about payday loans.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah. The payday loan subcommittee first meeting, Representative Farset, for January 10th, and then she wants to have two hearings, if the speaker approves the schedule, two hearings. The first one will be kind of overview, so it won't be a hearing for all comers. It'll be invited testimony and panels, and then two hearings, one in the Eugene area and one in the Portland area, in the February, March, April time frame, and then a final meeting back in Salem in September. So she's asking for four meetings. The first one's been set for January 10th. So, and if you, I might send an email out to see if members of this, the full committee that are not on the subcommittee, want notices of those meetings. We can let you know, especially if it's in your area.
Great.
For sure, let you know.
I got changed.
Excuse me. I think.
Is it the 10th?
It's the 10th. Okay. No, it's the 11th. Thank you.
That's what I had, was the 11th.
Okay. That transportation is the 10th. Okay. Excuse me. January 11th. Thank you, Pam.
Anything else?
When are we going to talk about tire stores and their consumer protection.
I checked that list very carefully.
Legislative discounts.
Restaurants wasn't on there.
Seasons Brewing. This was
number 5.
Number 11?
Yeah.
It make it list. Anything else? Well, Merry Christmas to everyone,
yeah.
And happy holidays, and we will be adjourned.